brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT.
Hi, I'm Kevin Davis. Thanks for tuning in to our On SOA podcast. Today, we're back talking with Chris Riley. Chris is a senior consultant with SOA Systems and co-author of the recently released book, SOA Design Patterns, the most recent work in the service-oriented computing series from Thomas Earle. Today, we continue our discussion on versioning concepts and patterns in service-oriented architecture. Chris, thanks for taking the time to share your experience with us today.
Thanks, Kevin. Great to be here.
Okay, so now last time we talked about forwards and backwards compatibility. We talked about a lot of different versioning strategies and, you know, even getting into ESB a little bit for, you know, from a pattern standpoint. But one of the things that the service contract, the design book talks about, there's three different strategies for compatibility, and that'd be loose, strict, and flexible. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a summary of those and some maybe examples of when you'd use each?
Sure. Yeah, so the basic premise that we have in the book is this notion that, you know, what we see in the field, again, because there isn't really a standards body that owns this and says this is what you shall do, is we wanted to look to our, you know, out to the field, to our customers, to the vendors, to guide what is actually happening out there. And what they found are kind of these three approaches. And let me describe each of them. We start off with strict. We'll talk a little about flexible, and then we'll talk about loose, which is the final. In the strict scenario, the idea behind this is that anytime I make any kind of change in the contract, and again, the contract would be a WSDL, it would be XML schema or policy if that's being applied. If anything occurs to change any of those, which would then impact, you know, the other elements that go with that, we then need to effectively create a new version. So the idea behind this is maybe I add an element to my XML schema. As soon as I do that, it changes everything from a contract and versioning perspective. I now bump up my version, and I therefore have to then provide that to my consumers. And effectively what occurs in this is that usually this causes a break or a problem with the consumer. So the consumer is going to have a brand new contract. The namespace is an example and is typically utilized to identify the major versions. That will have been incremented, and any consumers of that contract will then be broken, and we'll have to create effectively a new consumer to then take advantage of this new service. So it's a very, again, strict approach, meaning any change, whether it's something that's a minor change, referred to typically as a compatible change, or a major change, which is referred to as an incompatible change, requires a brand new version identifier. And thus, from a consumer perspective, it's a brand new contract. It's a very simple approach. Not a lot of thought, you know, that goes into it, but it effectively is very impactful for any consumers using it. Another approach that we can talk about is flexible. Flexible is probably the most common strategy that we see with customers, and this is where anytime you have a change that is compatible, meaning that it's an addition, we talked about backward compatibility, for instance, in the previous discussion. So, for instance, adding an operation to a contract or maybe adding an optional element to a schema or adding a policy alternative, these would be all examples of things that are not impactful to existing consumers. They don't have to take advantage of it. It's usually a minor version change, so it's not a 1.0 to 2.0. It's a 1.0 to 1.1 as an example. We refer to that as a compatible change. And in that particular case, flexible strategy focuses on this notion that if it's a compatible change, then basically we're effectively going to maintain what we have in terms of the namespace. We'll update the incremental number, the minor number, but consumers will continue to use this particular contract. So backward compatibility is supported within this strategy. On the downside, one of the things that can happen, though, is if we support backward compatibility, and we talked a little bit about this in the previous session, is that the contract can kind of get bloated. We keep adding to it. We don't remove the data definition itself may get large because we kept adding these optional elements. And over time, it may become kind of unattainable. We want to maybe redo the whole contract and start from scratch. So contracts that get large and kind of bloated over time can occur in this type of a strategy. The final strategy is a loose strategy, and there are others, I'm sure, that exist beyond this, but these are the three common ones. And in a loose strategy, the notion here is that you're trying to focus more on this notion of forward compatibility. It supports both backward and forward compatibility, but really, you know, kind of hedges more on the forward compatibility side. And what we talked about the last time is this notion of creating very coarse contracts contracts that support a wide range of content. Typically, they use wildcards or any elements, effectively very generic in nature, and thus it's really the responsibility of the lodger behind the scenes to deal with the data versus the contract itself. So in these particular instances, it's great for consumers because they can pretty much send a wide range of information in, but it's really, you know, from a con perspective, it's up to the owner of that service, the provider, to then deal with that information accordingly. And this one also, again, requires some forethought. You know, what is it that people are sending in? Can I envision what they're going to be sending in, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now? Or maybe it's even just a few months from now. Whereas in the flexible approach that's the most commonly used, we're really trying to tie in and describe the business information directly and very cleanly. And in these particular three scenarios, the strict and the loose are the ones that are the most difficult to apply, whereas the flexible is the most common and kind of has the middle range application and complexity. So thus, many consumers and providers, you know, take advantage of that approach.
So a couple of things come out of that. I guess the first one that I want to make sure that everyone understands is this concept of wildcarding.
Sure.
Within, you know, it's really key to being able to do any kind of forward compatibility, right?
Absolutely.
I don't know if you call it a keyword or the any, I always say the any tag when I'm looking at schema design myself. So,
Right. Yeah, so within, you know, schema as an example, and WSDL, there are different types of types, for instance, that you can use to describe the data. So as an example, if I had an element saying, for, you know, called first name would more likely than not be some type of string, as an example. That's the most common way that we describe it. So you'd use a XML schema string type to define the type of data that it is. And then when the system receives the request, it's going to parse and validate that it matches to a string type. Likewise, there are other elements that you can apply, and one of them is an any element, which allows you to specify that there really is no, you know, strictness of that data. It could be anything. You could pass it in as a float. It could be 1.100, you know, e to the negative 09, and then the next minute you could send in a string, and then the next minute you could send in an integer. So it's a very opaque, coarse type of data structure or data type that effectively you can send anything in. And thus, when I apply that in a contract, I allow a wide range of data to be sent in. An example I kind of described about previously was using attachments as an example, which is another approach where you can send in data, binary data. Maybe it's images or audio files or things of that nature. And obviously the encoding and the way the data is represented may be different for each of these. And people in the past have used any to then allow, you know, this flexibility of having a wide range of data come in. Wildcards is an approach that you can apply within WSDL contracts that allows you to kind of describe that, you know, the data and the structure of information or the expected input that's coming in is unknown, and thus anything that is passed and is allowed. So it really provides a very coarse validation, and that's really where versioning comes in. Is it's really around validation. Am I validating in a very fine, granular way or a very coarse way? And depending upon the changing of that validation, thus I may have some versioning issues that I have to deal with.
So basically, if I've got a WSDL with some wildcards specified in there, it basically means, is it I can send in anything at all, or is it just any well-formed XML? Does it have to be a tag that's parsable, but they don't care, it doesn't matter what it is?
Yeah, it would still have to be, as an example, some kind of element that you're sending in.
Okay.
But then the validation of the type of data, as an example, with the any, the type of that information is something that is not as restrictive as you would have with a string or a float or an integer. So I wouldn't have to deal with an XSD string or an XSD integer. You could pass in a wider range of data. And thus, it's a much more flexible way of, you know, from a consumer perspective, of being able to send in pretty much anything, you know, over the time of and life of that particular contract.
Right. So then with these three types of the loose, strict, and flexible strategies for compatibility here, the loose really relies on being able to send in less validated data. And you said that that the strict and loose were hardest to implement and flexible has the most market share. Which is the most successful?
In terms of my personal experience with customers I'm working with, typically flexible is the one that has the most success. And it really comes down to, you know, the the complexity. You know, the simpler you can implement something and manage something, govern something, the more likelihood of success. So, you know, one customer that I've worked with in the past had focused on the flexible approach, whereby the contracts that we had identified and that we were defining were pretty static in nature. You know, they had been doing a particular business for quite a long time and really understood what the data was going to look like. And thus, the amount of change that was going to occur in that environment was not dramatic. It was incremental. It wasn't major. Now, in environments where you have a lot of change going on, where maybe the business is changing quite a bit, and where the information, the data that represents that business is changing quite a bit, a flexible strategy may not be as successful because you have many more versions that you have to deal with. You may have to retire previous versions that you had created. Maybe your contracts become too bloated, or maybe the structure of how you defined it is completely irrelevant, you know, 6 months, 3 months after the date you've implemented the service itself. So I think a couple things that you could take away would be, how dynamic is the business, and is the business something that's static and well-structured and well-known, or is it something that is changing all the time, you know, new products and services that are very different from one another, and thus you may want to consider, you know, creating something that is much more generic and limiting the overall versioning challenges that you may have. So more dynamic environments, versioning becomes obviously much more challenging. A loose strategy may be more applicable. It requires more forethought and more design time, but likewise, you potentially get a bigger benefit in that type of scenario. But in most businesses that I'm dealing with, the brick-and-mortar types of businesses, they know what a purchase order looks like, and they know what, you know, other business documents look like. They don't change that often, that frequently, and thus a flexible approach is very common in those types of environments.
And do you typically see customers starting out? There's a couple different dimensions to what you just said, and one is that if it's static information and or it's an established business, or maybe it's a particular vertical, that doesn't change or is well known, or is even there's strong sort of oversight, you know, even potentially legal oversight on, then those things can be very, very strict. Does this change over the lifetime of a service? Do you typically see your customers starting out with trying to be a little bit looser about how things defined, and as they evolve, they lock it down more and more as their schemas become more mature?
Yeah, I mean, based on my experience and the implementations out there, service-oriented architecture and the versioning of that is something that's relatively new, and what I mean by that is, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. So in terms of the business that I've been dealing with, the majority of them are just getting into the game over the past couple of years, and they haven't hit that situation where they started with, you know, we're going to start with a very loose scenario. We'll mature it and define it over time, and thus maybe eventually migrate to more of a flexible strategy. Most of them coming into are starting with really, you know, pretty well-defined and well specified data as well as processes, things that they want to automate rather than integrating applications. They're interested in trying to break down their business into services and thus compose them. So I have not run into that scenario where we're working with, you know, starting with loose and then migrating to a different strategy. Usually it's the companies identifying, we're going to build, you know, building our domain service inventory. We're going to start off with something that's either dynamic or static. Most companies are picking things that they understand very well, and that falls into typically service-oriented analysis, where you're trying to look over a series of processes for commonality, and through that commonality, developing services that can support that logic.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So as these companies are getting more mature and their service bases are getting more mature, they're probably implementing more things that are coming out of the WSI, the WS Splat stack, the web services stack, security, policy, addressing, all of these things that reliable messaging, metadata. Does that add, you know, does each thing that you add that much more complexity to your versioning?
I think, you know, taking a look at it from a perspective of the version that we've been speaking of, we're typically speaking of just the core standards, the WSDL, the schema, the policy. And even policy is a more recent standard that people are just starting to apply now. So in most environments, we're talking just plainly about WSDL and XML schema for the most part. And in those particular instances, the WSStar standards, these are standards that provide quality of service. So you may have environments that use them or may not use them at all. the versioning that occurs within those particular standards, you know, is really specifying whether you're in a draft standard or a standard that is released and effectively, you know, GA, I guess you could refer to it as. And in my experiences of dealing with customers, the versioning of that really hasn't caused problems from the WS stack. That versioning has not caused problems with versioning of the services themselves. What it has caused problems with is more on the interoperability side. And what I mean by that is that as an architect, if I decide to take advantage of, say, for instance, WS security, and I'm using 1.0, and I'm using maybe XML encryption or XML digital signatures, or maybe I'm using SAML, for instance, each of these standards will have, you know, a released version, or they may be only at a draft state. And the technologies that you're using to support those, you have to make sure, first of all, that they support them. You know, if you want to architect it, then you have to have a platform that can run and support those standards. And then more importantly, you know, if we're building a service, we're really interested in trying to, you know, garner up consumers that are going to take advantage of this. And those consumers, a lot of times, are not only just inside your organization, but also outside your organization. So then the question becomes, is, will my consumers support these standards? Do they, you know, can they use the latest version of SAML? Can they use the latest version of WS addressing? Can they use the latest version of WS reliable messaging? And what I have found in my own experience is that that is where, you know, problems occur. Typically, it's on the B2B side, where you don't have control of the consumer end, and the consumer is unable to use a particular version of the standard, or their vendor doesn't support it, or you have incompatibilities. One vendor is using the draft version, whereas another vendor is not. Those are the types of issues that I've seen. So it comes down to interoperability more so than it impacting the actual versioning approaches that you're using within your services.
I understand. I guess I was also curious about how, let's say, you know, you were talking about earlier, how does a policy change affect the version of your contract? I mean, is the policy definition included in the contract? Is it?
Yeah, so the policy, it really depends on how you've implemented them. Ideally, you'd like to have, in most cases, I like to try to have the policy externalized from the actual WSDL itself and referred to within the WSDL contract, but you can also put policy elements inside of the actual WSDL itself. So it depends on how the person's implemented it. And the one challenge that, as you mentioned in the previous podcast, was the discussion of if I make a change to the WSDL or the schema or the policy, that you want to then reflect that back in the hub or the core. And the hub or the core of a service contract, if using web services, would be the abstract portion of the WSDL. So would that mean, well, as an example, if I were to make a minor capability change within a policy, and what would that be? That'd be, for instance, a policy alternative or an optional assertion. These add new functionality to the policy, giving a consumer more choices of, you know, what policy they would like to choose and exercise. If I were to add that, that would be considered a compatible change. And a compatible change then typically means an incrementing of the minor version of the contract. And what we would see in that particular instance, depending upon the strategy that you're using, you know, if it's a flexible or loose strategy, we're going to try to maintain our consumers and make sure they're continuing to be compatible with us. And the way we do that is we just increment the attribute within the WSDL contract, which is something that is not impactful to the consumers. If I were to create something, however, that is an incompatible change within the policy, an example of that may be an ignorable assertion. This would be indicating that I'm going to do some processing. You're telling the consumer, I'm going to do this processing when you invoke the service. An example, maybe logging of the request for Sarbanes-Oxley is an example. That type of change could be considered incompatible, and that means a major version number. And that means it's impactful to the consumer, because what happens usually in most major versions is they become incompatible changes. And the consumer, thus, would then see a contract that has the namespace change. So the namespace would have now a version 2 instead of a version 1. That changes the request, and the consumer then has to be updated accordingly to support that and effectively communicate that way. So with policy changes, depending upon whether you're doing compatible or incompatible changes, as we describe in the book, you then would be considering either minor or major version, and thus either something that is going to be impactful to the consumer or not, and those minor major versions are reflected in the, you know, the minor version attributes and documentation element of the contract, or the major version be typically identified in the WSDL namespace.
That was a really excellent description of what's going on. And so one of the things that I keep coming back to, especially with versioning, is that versions need to be marked obsolete. We were talking a little bit about the flexible, if you have a flexible schema and you've been adding elements, or even adding operations to a WSDL, and you want to do a major refactoring, or you want to really just deprecate something altogether. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to mark these things as, please don't use me anymore, I'm going away?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple ways of doing it. And this is something that's pretty common, that you know, you build something and you hope that it lasts forever, and the reality is that 6 months or 12 months later, it's the point that it needs to be redone. So you have all these consumers, or maybe you don't even know how many consumers are using the service, which is quite common. So, I mean, something simple that you could apply. I mean, again, these are design standards. You know, you want to say anytime we need to terminate a service, you have to do this. And one of the things that consumers will do, or service providers will provide, is just a simple documentation element within the WSDL itself saying, look, you know, this particular contract that we have in here is going to be terminated on such and such a date. So really what you're doing is you're kind of putting like a termination notification within the actual contract itself. And this is a design pattern that we talk about in the SOA Design Patterns book as well. Now, termination notification from a design pattern perspective can also be implemented in more intelligent ways. And one of the ways, if a consumer is using or the provider is using WS policy, is to put inside of it either ignorable or mandatory termination assertions. And what ignorable means is that you're electronically telling somebody that, look, I'm putting a custom assertion in here that's saying, look, I'm going to be terminated on such and such a date. Now, ignorable means that the consumer can look at it and do nothing with it. It doesn't matter. It's not impactful to their processing. A mandatory assertion requires that the consumer actually examine it and effectively process that portion of the assertion itself, and thus it guarantees that the consumer is going to have to deal with it. So both the ignorable and mandatory assertions provide ways programmatically to have a consumer effectively interact and understand that there's a time or date that this particular contract is not going to be available at. Both of them, because they're defined within XML, whether I just simply document it in the contract or use these assertions, are human readable as well. So it gives another mechanism via people checking things and saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to take advantage of the service. And then they say, oh, there's a documentation element or there's an assertion in here that's telling me that the service is going to be terminated on such and such a date. It's something that at least gives you another option. So both computer and human mechanisms can be put in place depending upon how it's implemented.
What it comes down to for me is that versioning is really, really tough. No matter how you cut it, whether in an automated way or in a human-readable way, the interaction, the deprecation, the compatibility issues surrounding version is really, really tricky. And
absolutely,
I really appreciate having this the service contract design and versioning book around. I think it's a very good introduction to all of these topics. Chris,
absolutely,
I'd like to thank you for sharing your experience with us today. Chris Riley is the co-author of the book SOA Design Patterns. It's available now. For more information on design patterns for SOA, check out www.soapatterns.org. Chris, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Appreciate it, Kevin. It was great.
This episode was brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast at iTunes or check us out at informit.com/onsoa.